Transformation is inevitable, but it doesn't have to take forever. What if you could see the obstacles before they happen, sidestep the common mistakes, and drive change faster than ever? That's exactly what we're here to do. Welcome to Transformation Unfiltered, the podcast where HR professionals share their stories about how they've hit fast forward on their transformation efforts and built legacies as world-class people leaders and change makers. And now, here's the show.
This took a while to address, to tease out the cultural things and to address them. We recognized that people weren't even reporting safety incidents because they were afraid and they didn't trust leadership. That was really one of the biggest things. And so this is where we had to do more listening tours and letting people know, here's what we're trying to do. Here's why we're trying to do it. Here's how we're trying to do it. We went back into doing more. It wasn't an employee engagement survey, but it was more of a suggestion box where people could put their private suggestions in, and they knew that there was going to be confidentiality. And so if they brought up an issue or a concern, there was not going to be retribution. And so there was a fear of retaliation there at the distribution center. So those things began to come out. We actually began to engage more of the supervisors and do more leadership training so that they could understand how to engage their team in a developmental and a coaching way, rather than just bringing bad news or being punitive in their engagement with them. And so it shifted, and it did shift. It took a while, but from year over year while I was there, the employee engagement survey stats improved, our safety performance improved, our productivity, because then you don't have a culture of fear. You have a culture of commitment where people, like, we're all working on one team towards the same goal. It was difficult though, I will tell you.
You've just earned your first big promotion. And it's not just a promotion, it's a complete move from one group to another. And you're leading HR. Here's the kicker. You're dropped into a turnaround effort. You've gotten this promotion and you're leading a group that has been underperforming and has been historically underperforming for quite a while. And you're just getting your legs underneath you, and you're confronted with a scenario where you have a quote unquote problem employee that you need to deal with. Now, you're aware of this employee. This is someone who's come across your radar before. So you know the story, or at least that's what you think. So you rubber stamp the recommendation that this person be disciplined, and then you find out that you jumped the gun. So not only did you make a mistake, you made a mistake that has career implications on somebody else. So how do you recover from that? How do you make it right? This is a situation that Regina Ross actually encountered earlier in her career. She's a transformational leader and dynamic communicator with over 30 years of experience driving organizational change and unlocking human potential. She's the Executive Vice President, Chief People and Operations Officer at Opportunity Finance Network. And Regina leads enterprise-wide strategy and transformation initiatives that empower mission-driven organizations to scale impact. Prior to joining OFN, Regina served as the Chief People Officer at Khan Academy and held senior leadership roles at Target, Amazon, Pitney Bowes, and she's consistently bridged operations, HR, and change management throughout her career. She's known for her ability to translate ambitious business visions into people-centered strategies, and she helps organizations deliver measurable results while cultivating cultures of trust, agility, and performance. Regina, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dr. Jim. Glad to be here.
Nice having you. And this is the second time that you've done a show with me, but this time we get to do a little bit longer form conversation versus a 10-minute chat on a convention floor. We're gonna get into some interesting spaces that we wouldn't have had time for at a conference. So you ready to tear the Band-Aid off?
I'm ready. Let's do it.
So tell us about the time in your career where you did something, and in the moment, once you got a full view of what happened, you thought, oh crap, I'm going to get fired.
Yes. All right. So I was a fairly new HR leader, had transitioned from operations into HR, and I authorized corrective action for an employee that jeopardized their job. And after realizing that I made a mistake, I had to inform my regional HR leader. I had to submit a request to corporate headquarters to rescind the corrective action and expunge it from the employee's records. And so let me just tell you a little bit more. This was after crossing from ops leadership into my first HR role at Target. Our senior team was focused on improving the performance of our distribution center. We were ranked bottom in many categories, including safety. So we formed a safety committee that could help us evaluate accidents and injuries. And after that, they recommended remedies, including employee disciplinary action, if warranted. So my HR team presented to me the recommendation for a safety-related final written warning for a known problem employee who worked in the department that I had previously managed. And when the employee appealed her case to me, I investigated her case more thoroughly, and I realized that the corrective action was not warranted.
There's a lot there, and we're going to get to the use of air quotes when you say known problem employee, because that's going to be important to dig into. I want to back up a little bit and talk more about the circumstances of this role that you were in. You made the transition from operations to HR. And you made the transition from one function to another, and then you took on and you landed in a spot that's known for underperformance. So walk me through your headspace when you're making those transitions into this environment. What's going through your mind as far as the first 90 days or so in that role?
Yeah, for me, Dr. Jim, it was like I didn't grow up in HR and I wasn't trained as an HR person. And so I am coming to it from an analytical mindset. I'm an engineer by training and strategic planning and looking at this senior leadership team where we were not performing. And so how do I now in this enterprise-wide HR role help us drive performance, not just in my department, but across the entire organization? So I felt the pressure for us. So we've got to get out of the bottom ranking. We've got to do better as an organization. And I brought my biases of coming from an ops leader to now leading HR for the entire distribution center. I knew of people like who had been in my department. And so I was bringing some of that bias. I know these team members. I know this person. And so all of that was just this confluence. And I'll tell you another thing, too. When I stepped into the role, my regional HR leader said, "Hey, Regina, even though you didn't grow up in HR, your transition has been the smoothest and the best that I've seen." So there was no pressure, right? But I felt a little bit of that pressure to like lead the HR function in a good way and then also drive the performance of our distribution center so that we could start improving in our productivity, our safety, financial performance, and all of those things.
So that's interesting. A smooth transition from function to function, and you get that feedback.
Yes.
Now, if it were me getting that feedback, I might have gotten a little cocky. Do you feel like you might have gotten a little cocky in that circumstance?
I think so. And this is where I did not take the due diligence of really investigating, because I'm an engineer. So I know how to investigate something thoroughly, ask the questions, the five whys. I didn't do that in this case, Dr. Jim. And I believe that my bias for action and my desire to like show improvement and the feedback like, "Hey, Regina, this has been a great transition into the HR space," I was too confident. And so I did not do the thorough analysis that I would normally do in other roles and other functions. And that was my mistake.
So you just shared something that caught my attention, which was you're an engineer by trade. Mm-hmm. So you're used to like deconstructing things and figuring out how things work. But you also tied in something else that I didn't expect, which was bias for action. Usually my perception of engineers are methodical and systematic about the approach. How throughout your career, when you have that engineering mindset, but you also have the bias for action, how has that shown up in different ways, both good or bad, in the things that you do?
And so this is me, I believe, Dr. Jim, trying to overcompensate for my tendency to overanalyze. And so I've gotten feedback from my early days as an engineer that, Regina, you don't have to have a 99.5% confidence level. Like you've got to good enough is good enough, and you've got to know when to move. So I would tend to push myself to action without getting tripped up in my own tendencies to overanalyze. And so in this instance, I think that tendency or my effort to compensate for this trait of mine of analysis worked against my benefit because I just moved too fast. Typically, I would want to deconstruct. I would want to analyze. I would want to do the thorough. But I believe also I felt the pressure like we were not performing and we need to make a decision and take action.
Really interesting perspective. It reminds me of, there's an assessment that I took and I think it might be the Hogan, but it's a four quadrant, different colors. And it shows here's how you naturally are and here's what your stress behavior is and here's how others perceive you. And what you're describing reminds me of that assessment. It sounds like you might have been in like your stress behavior because of the urgency to prove things. That's my cereal box organizational psychology coming up. One of the other things that I want to circle back to is that because you were familiar with the group that you were transferring into, you mentioned that you might have brought in some of your biases.
Yes.
And this particular situation included a quote unquote known problem employee.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit more about how the known problem employee bias set you up for some issues.
So here's what happened. My HR business partners came and brought the situation to me. They mentioned the employee, and immediately my thoughts like, oh boy, here they go again. And I believe they had some bias as well, because again, this was a problem, known problem employee. And so I did not ask the detailed questions. They did not present more details around the situation. And I went to a conclusion very quickly because of my history and because of most of the team's history with this particular individual. And it was not until the employee, thank goodness that she had the courage, they had the courage to come and speak with me and it presented the situation and shared their perspective. I'm like, oh my gosh. And of course, I didn't immediately say, oh, we're wrong, but I took her information and then did the research and investigated the case, and she was absolutely right.
You found out that she was correct and that HR was in the wrong, but as you're doing your discovery, what's going through your head?
So what's going through my head is, how many other of these cases have we gotten wrong? Because we're on this mission of improving our safety performance, and how have we perhaps in the past jumped to conclusions that were not thoroughly investigated? And so that was one thing that I was thinking through. The other thing is, oh my gosh, so my regional HR leader has trusted me to make these decisions and has empowered me and given me a lot of autonomy. And I need to go back to her and say, I was wrong. And I need to acknowledge that. And not just to my regional HR leader, but then to the leadership team, where we were focused on making these improvements. But what about the humans that we're affecting? It's not just about performance and increasing our DC ranking. These are people's lives. And this was, I'm thinking through all of this, not just me and my leadership and what I'm owning, but how can I now use this example to influence and shape a shift in the way that we're managing people and not treating them just as a number, but looking at them as human beings and putting the human back in human resources. So all of that was going through my head.
There's a lot there. You have the individual issue that needs to be solved. You have a potential systemic issue that needs to be looked at. And then third, you have a cultural component to look at too, because let's be real, in a distribution center environment, largely with hourly employees, it's easy to fall into the mindset, if you're on the operations side of it or the management side of it, oh, if somebody isn't working out, there's probably 3 or 4 or 10 other people that are willing to take that job, and we can tear the Band-Aid off very quickly. So when you look at a multifaceted set of problems like that, how did you start tackling those things? You have to rectify the thing that you screwed up. So let's start there.
Yeah, that's where I started. And it was me acknowledging, after doing the research, actually going back to the leadership team and to my HR business partners and even the safety committee to say, hey, we got this wrong and here's why. And here's the steps that we took. Here are the additional measures that I looked into. And here's the determination that should have been reached had we done a thorough investigation. So I circled the wagons with them before going, because I wanted to invite them to challenge my thinking. They're the ones who came up with a recommendation, presented it to me, and I co-signed it and just went off to the races to implement a corrective action. And so they're like, yeah, you're right. There was not a pushback once I presented the case and presented the information. And so I wanted to make sure this was a coachable, teachable moment for them and make sure that we were aligned so that we would shift our mindset and our approach. That's the first step.
Looking back, you're looking at it as a coaching moment, but I'm putting myself into your shoes at that point, given the circumstances, switching into a new function, first sort of major leadership role in an underperforming location, and you screwed something up. I would be in my head thinking, oh crap, I got to go into my principal's office and fix this, and I'm already starting off on the wrong foot by a fairly significant mistake that could have gotten somebody fired. So how did you compartmentalize that potential line of thought in your brain to turn it into a coaching moment? Are you able to tap into that moment and share with us how you actually split those things apart so that you could actually move forward and get a resolution?
For me, it was about what is the right thing to do. And so I maybe checked my ego, and it's not about me. It's about the culture. It's about this employee. It's about, am I going to set a trend and a precedent of just like bulldozing over team members? And so it really wasn't about me. And I didn't think about necessarily, okay, what are the implications for me? I wanted to make it right because that was the right thing to do. I also trusted and had a good relationship with my regional HR leader. She had given me a lot of autonomy. I made good decisions. I was tapped on the shoulder by the regional team and asked to step into the HR leadership role because during a unionizing campaign, they saw that me as a senior operations leader, I was leading my function and my department very well. My team was very engaged. So they saw that and wanted me to bring that into a broader impact across the entire organization. So I had a lot of, I guess, proof points and receipts that I'm a good leader. And so I didn't think about, okay, this is a major mistake. I'm a horrible leader. No, I knew that I had a good track record. And I believe that was going to count for me. My focus was like, I've got to make this right.
After hearing you talk through it, even in an absence of institutional trust, if somebody is in that sort of environment, your point about I have to make this right should be the thing that somebody who is in that same situation should be focused on. Do the right thing. So that's how you move forward on the individual side. And you made your recommendations. The recommendations were received. Then what happened?
Then I talked to the employee. So after the leadership team, the HR business partners, the safety committee, yeah, Regina, we see this. I went to her one-on-one and I apologized. And I said, we got this wrong. I'm sorry for making this judgment and the implications. And I told her, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to reach out to my regional leader in headquarters to let them know that this disciplinary action needs to be rescinded. And so I couldn't promise anything, but I told her I'm going to take accountability for this. And then the next step was to do just that. Tell my regional HR leader, we got it wrong. Here's why. Reach out to headquarters to get them to, because that's where all the corrective actions were stored, to get that removed from the employee's record. And then even though my regional HR leader still trusted me and she applauded me for taking accountability, I said, hey, here's what I want to do. I want to make sure that going forward, I am going to, one, make sure that my HR team, when they present things to me, they present only the known facts without naming the employees involved. So I will not allow my halo bias or my horn bias to influence my decisions. We all have bias. So that's one thing that I did locally. And then the second thing I asked my regional HR leader, I want to make sure that there's others that can just check me and check my reasoning and my decisions. So I didn't submit things to her, but there is a corporate employee relations legal partner. And I began to take him as a partner just to make sure I wasn't, again, jumping to conclusions, especially me learning and as an HR professional and as an HR leader to look at all the facts, look at different aspects versus just productivity or numbers or safety. So those are a couple of things that I put in place because I know that the greater your authority and the greater your influence is as a leader, the greater the necessity to acknowledge and to mitigate your biases.
So that's, you're setting up some internal controls to make sure that this doesn't happen again.
Yes.
At the individual level. But you hinted earlier that there might be some systemic issues along these lines if this was the SOP that led you to this point. So what were the things that you did from a systemic perspective to make sure that this doesn't happen again?
Yeah. So one, not just for the HR business partners, Dr. Jim, but also for the safety committee, when they investigated something and presented their recommendations, not to name the employee, just to stay on the facts, there wouldn't be that bias that was there. We implemented a more stringent investigation process, like following the five whys. So we updated actually our safety incident form to dive into a bit more detail so that we could make sure that we were not just looking at things on cursory perspective. And I know that we looked at the composition of our safety committee And we needed to add a few more hourly representatives on that committee so that we can have just a more well-rounded, not just supervisors, not just team leads, but forklift drivers and packers, and just to make sure that there was good representation, like a jury of your peers, right? Who have different perspectives and backgrounds. And we, so if you just pick who you like, the people who the leadership team likes, then you can have a safety committee that could be slanted towards making decisions that are for the company. And so we actually had to round it out a bit.
So that's interesting that this committee was, prior to making the adjustments, more skewed towards the management or the company side. It didn't have hourly representation. Were there?
It did have hourly representation, but they were like team leads or so. I think we just needed to spread it out a bit more. And we did have representation from each department, but we needed to look further and not just the favorite people.
The other thing that I'm thinking about when you describe this, and we flagged this as a potential issue earlier, where there might have been some cultural things in terms of how the distribution center operates that needed to be looked at or solved for as well. So what were some of those cultural things that you discovered in the process of this mini transformation? And how did you actually like mitigate and solve for those embedded issues?
That this took a while to address, to tease out the cultural things and to address them. We recognized that people weren't even reporting safety incidents because they were afraid and they didn't trust leadership. That was really one of the biggest things. And so this is where we had to do more listening tours and letting people know, here's what we're trying to do. Here's why we're trying to do it. Here's how we're trying to do it. We went back into doing more. It wasn't an employee engagement survey, but it was more of a suggestion box where people could put their private suggestions in, and they knew that there was going to be confidentiality. And so if they brought up an issue or a concern, there was not going to be retribution. And so there was a fear of retaliation there at the distribution center. So those things began to come out. We actually began to engage more of the supervisors and do more leadership training so that they could understand how to engage their team in a developmental and a coaching way, rather than just bringing bad news or being punitive in their engagement with them. And so it shifted, and it did shift. It took a while, but from year over year while I was there, the employee engagement survey stats improved. Our safety performance improved. Our productivity, because then you don't have a culture of fear. You have a culture of commitment where people, like, we're all working on one team towards the same goal. It was difficult, though. I will tell you.
The thing that I find interesting is that you start to discover that the environment is high fear, low trust. And then you start doing all of these things that is designed to generate feedback. And later on, you implement some coaching elements in it too. And when I hear all of that, those are all the right things. How did you bridge the gap in a way that met people where they are so that you could actually bring them along to those things? Because if I'm an individual contributor, an hourly in a distribution center, and I don't trust management and I fear for retaliation, I'm not going to share anything. So to go from that to a place where people are openly sharing in those listening tours or even putting suggestions in, there's a lot of work that needs to be done in between. So what were the things that you did in between that to get them to a place where they're sharing that sort of stuff in any number of different ways?
A lot of it was engaging the frontline supervisors, because they are the ones that are really the face of the employee to the face of the company to the employees. But what I realized too is that our supervisors felt disengaged, disempowered. There was a cultural fear with them, and we could not get down to the hourly staff level without addressing what the supervisors were feeling. So that was the key focus.
So that makes sense. If you want to make an impact at the line level, frontline managers are usually your first line of defense, but your frontline managers, supervisors, they were disengaged. They weren't feeling that they were invested in this. So how did you fix that?
Yeah, it was so interesting. One of the things that I saw from the surveys, the engagement surveys, was supervisors felt like, and I won't say the name of the area, but they felt like they were stuck there and they couldn't grow. And there was no real focus on their development. We recruited a lot of people from a college that was nearby, but then they would come into this small rural town and just feel lost. It really started with, there was a campaign that I led, was owning your own development. And we like We built a leadership development library. We had these lunch and learns. There was a group. It was a grassroots effort too, where there were people who were really vested in development and growth. And I leveraged them and we came together. Like, how can we tap into each person's strengths? How can we show that we're invested? And so it was that effort. And again, it wasn't anything that was a formal top down from headquarters, but it was showing the supervisors and the frontline leaders, we care about you, about your development, about your growth, about your career at our organization. And it's not just here where you feel like you're stuck at our DC. We actually begin to show the internal mobility of allowing people to transfer to. So one of our goals was being an exporter of talent. So you come here, you're going to grow, you're going to be able to perform well, you're going to have a great story to tell. And then now we're going to be able to export you as great talent to the rest of the network. And that was exciting. And so the feedback and the engagement and the level of the commitment from our supervisor staff, like, really went up. And then you saw the impact on the hourly staff, the frontline staff, when they had supervisors who showed that they cared, who were engaged with them, and not just developing themselves, but then they began to reach down and develop the frontline staff into team leads, and there were promotions. So our internal mobility rates went up. It was the supervisors made such a big difference.
So it might not be a straight line, but it's interesting that you're describing a facility that's an underperforming facility and has all sorts of systemic issues and cultural issues in terms of trust and fear and all of that. And it sounds like the root cause was a lack of growth opportunity at the manager level and a lack of development opportunity. Were there any other root causes that you identified that you triaged to help solve that?
One was not having a clear strategic vision. And so this was some work that I started when I was a senior operations leader and then carried that through when I stepped into the HR leader role. What are our goals? What's our strategy? What's our objectives? And then aligning around that. And so we had three major goals. And as a senior leadership team, we began to rally around those goals. We involved our group leaders and our supervisors and our team members. And so now seeing a clear vision of where we're trying to get to as an organization, where we're not just being the ones who are always at the bottom. Like, when you're always at the bottom, that sucks. And it doesn't foster a sense of pride, and just being clear, crystal clear about our vision, and then taking input and making it a collaborative effort of how we're going to get there. We began to report on a regular basis of how we're doing, and then people could see us climbing up the distribution ranking. And so I think that was one other thing too. It wasn't just the supervisors, but it was also now having a compelling vision of, oh, we can actually be better. We can actually compete. And now we can be a place where people come and train because we're proud of the work that we do and the way that we do it. I think that was something that spread throughout the entire facility and gave people more of a sense of pride in what they did.
So what I find interesting about what you're describing is when you take over a turnaround project, there's a couple of directions you can go. And I feel like a lot of people often go on the metric side of it. What's easily measurable, what's like clearly below requirements from a KPI perspective, and let's fiddle with that and focus on the activity side. And it sounds like what you uncovered is there were all these higher order things that needed to be fixed that would have downstream impacts on the KPIs. And it's difficult to focus on the higher order things because they don't have immediate payoff. And what I'm wondering is that if you were making the case to focus on these higher order things that don't have immediate payoff, how would you make that case for somebody else to make that to their senior leadership? Hey, I know that these things on our scoreboard or our dashboard are all like below requirements, but that's not actually what we need to focus on. We need to focus on these other things. How do you have that conversation?
It was actually a conversation that we need to focus on both. And if I remember our top three goals from a strategic planning perspective is top 10, union free, and one voice. Okay, so we top 10, we were focused on the metrics. We knew that we wanted to remain union free because we, again, as I mentioned, we had a unionizing campaign, and there was just a lot of fear in the culture about what that would mean for jobs and for the leadership and all of that, and just losing that ability to engage with each other. And then one voice. where we really wanted to make sure that there was a unified voice across the leadership. And so you're talking about all three of those. And let me give you an example. So when I was a senior regional transportation leader with Target before moving into operations, before moving into HR, and my facility, my department was bottom ranked. So what I did, I looked at the metrics to figure out what was going on, where we ranked low. I benchmarked some other facilities that were doing a really good job. And then I began to teach my team and ask them, hey, did you understand that we're ranked low here? Help me understand. So it was an engagement and an empowerment of empowering my team to make the decisions, to understand what was being measured, why it was important, and then coaching them and training them, and then recognizing them when they made the right decisions and started seeing the improvements. And so that was, you can do both. They're not mutually exclusive. You can focus on KPIs while still focusing on culture, a culture of empowerment, a culture of accountability, a culture of celebrating and recognizing achievements. And so I didn't have to make the case of, oh yeah, let's focus on culture and then let's forget about the KPIs. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it's, I like your call out that you can do both. Sometimes I tend to focus on one or the other. And my default is always the bigger order pictures and create the fence for other people to operate in. But it's a good point that you made that you can do both. And having a unifying vision allows you to do that. So when I take inventory of this conversation, the conversation started talking about an individual screw up, but we got into systemic issues that needed to get resolved and cultural issues that need to be transformed as well. And we're condensing an entire arc of experience into a handful of minutes, but you were able to do that. And when you look at the playbook that you built when you did that, how did building that playbook position you for accelerating success in other roles that you took on after this one?
That's a great question. When I was in this role, I was not yet an executive coach. I'm a certified and trained coach now. And the learning to become a coach was really important. And there's one thing that Michael Bungay Stanier says in his book, The Advice Trap. He says, we need to learn to stay curious a little bit longer and avoid rushing to judgment or advice giving. So that's one key takeaway from this experience. If I had stayed curious a little bit longer in this first case, and just, okay, why? Help me understand why. Then I probably would not have made that wrong decision. All right. So that's one thing that I'm still using today. How do you, as leaders, how do we stay humble? How do we stay curious? How do we just ask questions and not rush to giving advice? Okay. And so for me, like I'm practicing asking those five whys to get to the root cause of an issue. Another thing for me is it's important for leaders to acknowledge that we make mistakes and that we can use those mistakes as teachable, coachable moments to help shape not just our professional development, but the development of the people that we lead. At Target, there was something that we had to read when we onboarded, feedback is a gift. And so I've learned how to solicit and to value the gift of feedback. That's something I bake into my one-on-ones. It is something that is so important because we as leaders, particularly as the higher we go, we can have blind spots and we only see what we see. How do we widen our aperture? How do we make sure that we're curious, that we're humble, that we solicit, invite, and value feedback from others?
That's really good input. And I want you to expand on that a little bit. Imagine that you're speaking to somebody that just got their first big promotion, and they're now taking on a turnaround effort as their first big promotion. What's the advice that you have, informed by the experience that you had, on how they should approach that first 90 days, 6 months in getting a lay of the land and building their action plan?
Great question, because that's what I was doing. Stepping into this role, a turnaround situation. So I think one thing is to strike the balance between standing in your confidence. That's one thing you want to do, establish yourself as the leader and show the confidence. So strike that balance between standing in your confidence. Yes, you belong in your role. You also need to recognize that you don't know it all and you won't get everything right. So when I worked at Amazon, there were two leadership principles that I think it articulates this tension very well. One leadership principle was leaders are right a lot. So you're expected to be right a lot as a leader. And the other one was leaders are vocally self-critical. So we've got to be like, look at myself and just examine my own stuff. And, oh, okay, let me critique myself and invite others to critique me as well. The other thing, and this is what I mentioned I did at the end of the scenario, invite others to challenge your thinking. So yes, you're in this role. Yes, you have every right to be there. Yes, you are a confident leader, but invite others to challenge your thinking, whether you get trusted colleagues or members of your team. And so if you surround yourself with yes people, and it can be easy to do, especially as you get into higher levels of leadership. I don't know, Dr. Jim, if you've heard of the fairy tale, The Emperor's New Clothes. So the emperor was tricked into thinking he was wearing an invisible suit of clothes, and he didn't realize he was walking around butt naked because no one would tell him that he's naked. So as a leader, we can be walking and thinking, hey, follow me. We're charging ahead, and we could be like on the edge of a cliff, and we're surrounded by yes people. No one's going to tell us that we're about to fall off a cliff. Like, we've got to invite others to challenge our thinking and give us feedback.
That's great stuff. This has been a really good conversation, and I'm sure that people are going to want to pick your brain or reach out to you and continue the conversation online and offline. So what's the best way for them to get in touch with you if they want to do that?
So LinkedIn is where I live. That's my jam. People can also connect with me on my website. I am an executive coach. So walkonpurpose.com. I do have a LinkedIn, a private LinkedIn group. So this is for C-suite sisters, for women of faith who desire to find their leadership impact. So if that describes you, you can join there. And that's where I have a lot more content. And then I don't hang out on Facebook as much, but I do have a Walk on Purpose Facebook page. And then I manage a Facebook group, Sisters Resting in Christ. This is for Christian women who want to honor God's invitation to enter into rest. Because we have a lot going on. We're working, we're grinding, but we're also supposed to be rest. So that's where you can find me.
Speaking of rest, when do you sleep with all that stuff going on?
Yes, on Saturdays, I actually do practice Sabbath rest, and I'm pretty good about my bedtime. I'm usually in bed by 9 o'clock in the evening because I get up early. So I have to have regular rhythms of rest and work.
Great stuff, Regina. I appreciate you hanging out. When I think about this conversation, there's sort of five principles that I drew from the conversation that we just had. And the first of which is when you're stepping into these sort of environments, first big promotion, turnaround effort, you need to internalize that you earned your spot there and you shouldn't immediately be rushing to go, quote unquote, prove yourself. You're there for a reason. So don't feel like you need to prove yourself immediately. The second thing is don't go running into a direction before knowing what you're actually running into. You need to be deliberate about asking the question, what am I missing? I'm hearing and seeing these things. What am I missing? And you need to recognize that you don't know what you don't know. So you need to find people that are going to tell you what you don't know, so you're not running in the wrong direction. And all of that can be wrapped into one principle. Be disciplined about zooming out, and that'll keep you from getting into trouble. And oftentimes that's probably the toughest thing to do because we get wrapped up in our own ego and our own sense of having to make an impact too quickly that we have tunnel vision about the thing that we're facing. And that's how you end up getting into trouble, is because you're too myopic to recognize that you're not getting the whole picture. You're only getting a piece of the picture. So I appreciate you walking us through that experience. And I think that exercise of zooming out in bumper sticker format is going to help a lot of people make better decisions overall. So I appreciate you sharing that with us. For those of you who've been listening to this conversation, appreciate you hanging out. If you like the discussion, make sure you leave us a review on your favorite podcast player. And make sure you tune in next time, where we'll have another leader hanging out with us and sharing with us the mistakes that they made that ultimately ended up helping them hit fast forward on their career. Thank you for hanging out with us and listening to Transformation Unfiltered. If you found today's conversation valuable, leave us a 5-star review on your favorite podcast player. It helps us reach more changemakers just like you. Do you know someone who would be great as a guest on our show? Send us a message on LinkedIn or drop us an email. We'd love to hear your recommendation and appreciate the connection. See you next week for another episode featuring an HR leader just like you, who's hitting fast forward on change, impact, and transformation.